Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to a fantastic and very special episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. There weren't any really great movies coming out this weekend, nothing that we felt we could fill an entire podcast with. However, this past week was the Sundance Film Festival, and thus we have two special guests with us. It's just myself. Danny and Nick are taking the week off. Lucky guys. But joining me to talk about their highlights and lowlights of the Sundance Film Festival in this special episode are Jordan Raup, editor-in-chief at thefilmstage.com. Jordan.
Hello.
Hello. And Dan Mecca, managing editor of thefilmstage.com.
How you doing?
Pretty good. We are recording a little later than usual, so if every once in a while I curse and talk about how I'm blind, it's because the sun is coming through the window. Gentlemen. It's weird how much of the performance of this depends upon what time of day we do it. So...
We won't blame you for all of your expletives.
I'm actually wearing sunglasses right now, sitting at my computer.
This should be a video podcast,
right? I like to give context so the people at home can understand what's happening.
They know your pain. You want them to understand your pain.
Exactly. This is my artistic process for this. But no movie discussion today. We're just going to jump right into the main talk, which will be, as I said, the highlights and lowlights of the Sundance Film Festival. So, yeah, guys, I think we're going to go for the top five of each of your personal favorites first, and then we're going to do some lowlights, and then we're going to talk in general about some other aspects of the fest, other movies that maybe didn't make either list, but still caught your interest in a way that you feel worth expressing.
All right, Jordan, do you want to do five for me?
We'll just go back and forth, and then...
Okay, cool. Five, four.
Well, there's one crowning achievement, I think, which Dan could talk more about because he wrote the review, but we saw Before Midnight, which is the third film in Richard Linklater's trilogy, and it kind of just stood above every other film we saw, even though there was...
We can call this a spoiler alert for both of our number ones, and probably the number one of most every film critic we encountered at the Sundance Film Festival.
Yeah,
and that was Richard Linklater's film, and it was funny. It was one of these movies that was so... I don't know, so flawlessly good that it almost seemed like it was in a different festival that would also just happen to be the Sundance Film Festival. So, yeah, I don't know. It was just so effortless. Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy are so effortlessly just comfortable in these roles that it was just like an absolute joy to watch. And I feel like most people in Utah felt the same way.
Yeah, and obviously we don't want to spoil too much, but I think it's the most affecting of the three, and it goes to places you might think, but just goes so much deeper than in terms of their relationship than you think it might, I guess, on the outset. And so, if there's a better kind of final 45 minutes in a movie this year, that will be pretty special then.
Yeah, judging by the way Twitter blew up after that, and it was one of those things, I didn't go, obviously, so... This will be an entirely spoiler-free podcast for anyone who's worried.
But yeah, and the review is spoiler-free as well. You know what I mean?
Excellent. So, yeah. But I mean, yeah. I was just like, I was torn between these two worlds of wanting to read the responses on Twitter, and then also terrified that some guy was just going to ruin it, which I feel is how a lot of people approach stuff like that. So I'm really excited for when that movie hits the wide audience.
Yeah, and I guess with each movie, we should say if it's been picked up yet, and indeed that one hasn't picked up by Sony Pictures Classics, and Dan and I were kind of thinking it might either be like a late summer or a fall release. It's one of those movies that just, you know, it just speaks for itself. You know, you don't need, I mean, I'm sure they'll do an Oscar campaign for it, and it deserves everything it gets, but it's just such a great, fantastically written and performed movie.
So, and also arguably the most fascinating set movie of the three. It takes place in Greece, and you can just really feel every landscape, you know what I mean? Every kind of set piece, every walk they take.
Yeah.
You can really feel the kind of the beauty of the country. Not that you can in the other two films, you know, Paris and Vienna are also, you know, rendered beautifully in those films. But in this one, you know, I literally was looking up plane tickets to Greece after this movie ended, because because you're going to feel like you need to go there. It's so beautifully shot. But anyway, yeah, definitely something to look out for, and just a kind of a triumph of a trilogy for sure. So
yeah, and then I can talk about another film that I loved. This is a coming of age drama called The Spectacular Now, and it is from James Ponsoldt, who came to the festival last year with Smashed, an alcoholism drama starring Mary Elizabeth Winstead. And this movie sees her return in a very much smaller role, but it also deals with alcoholism a little bit, and it just tells the story of Miles Teller, who you might have seen in the Footloose remake, Rabbit Hole, Project X, and he's in 21 and Over. So, but this is by far his most substantial role, and by far, far and away, his best performance. It's kind of, the movie deals with this kid who's kind of, you know, just in high school. I think it's, you know, his last few months at high school, and he's kind of the popular kid, but he's fine with just not really looking towards the future at all. And then he links up with a kind of an unassuming girl who's not really in the popular crowd. And it sounds very conventional. And that girl's played by Shailene Woodley, who just broke out with The Descendants. And it sounds conventional, but I just love the script. Kind of really sells kind of a much more natural film than you might expect from something that sounds pretty cliched. Yeah.
It kind of, Jordan, wouldn't you say it kind of plays like a movie that John Hughes would have written and or directed in the 80s, you know, with a little bit more raw. It's a little bit more raw than those films, but it has kind of a Some Kind of Wonderful, you know what I mean, type of, you know, honesty about it, which you don't really find in a lot of these more recent, like, you know, if you're talking about Miles Teller, you're not going to find that kind of honesty in a Project X, you know what I mean? Like, it's this is a movie where...
Even though both films, like, contain parties and kind of, like, I mean, they're very different, but yeah. And yeah, I would say definitely I like teared up at least like 5 times towards the end of this movie. And it's just like his performance, I think, is just fantastic. And I really love this movie because most coming of age movies kind of just deal with that specific moment the character is in. And this one kind of shows you implications for what could happen if Miles Teller stays in this, living in the now, as he calls it. The Spectacular Now. And so it's
oh, really... oh wait, Spectacular Now?
Yeah, because the title.
Oh, The Spectacular Now? Great.
And there's a few little surprise performance which I didn't know going in, from Kyle Chandler, who is far removed from his previous characters that he's played. So definitely highly, highly recommended. That one was picked up by A24. And I would probably see it get released in the same time slot as like Before Midnight, maybe summer or fall.
500 Days of Summer slot, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, speaking of, yeah, for those, yeah, it does come from the 500 Days of Summer writers, and I think this is a much more accomplished work from them. So,
yeah, definitely.
Were you both fans of 500 Days of Summer?
Yeah.
I'm going to go, Jordan. What do you?
Well, yeah, yeah. I think I liked a considerable amount more than you, Dan, but it worked more so as like I would say like in terms of what's it, Mark Webb, right? Yeah, he directed it. It was more like a good like first step for him in terms of like I really like some of the visual ideas he used in that movie, but I was never as deeply affected in that movie as I was in this one.
Yeah, I mean I'm a lower tier on both of these films, you know what I mean? Like I'm not a huge fan of 500 Days and I don't love Spectacular Now. There's some narrative turns it takes that I have trouble going with completely, that I won't really delve into, but I was very much impressed by Spectacular Now, and I would just say, yeah, it just feels like a more mature piece of writing, honestly. It just feels like these two guys, Michael Weber and Scott Neustadter, they wrote 500 Days. It's a fun script and a very stylish comedy that's works and sometimes and doesn't work other times. In this movie, when it works on all cylinders, Spectacular Now, and it's definitely, it just has an honesty to it that you don't really see in 500 Days, in my opinion, so.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, let's get on to the next one, then.
Yeah, so I'll jump into, I'll combine a couple, these are two, probably like the 4 and 5 of the festival for me. I saw a documentary called Muscle Shoals. And it is a music documentary that is centered around Muscle Shoals, Alabama, which is a small town in Alabama with this recording studio called Muscle Shoals. And it is this, like, they paint it as this magical place where all the great blues, rock, you know, just all these great acts from the 50s, 60s, 70s all came to record their music because of the sound of the studio and just the nature of this small town and the band that lived, that played in this recording studio. They're called the Swampers, I believe. Yeah, and it's just, you know, they speak to anyone from Keith Richards, Mick Jagger, Bobby Womack is mentioned in it. Who else is in there? Alicia Keys speaks, Aretha Franklin. And they all talk about just the beauty of this place in Alabama that I had never even known about. I mean, I'm not a huge music buff in terms of these like small, you know, little facts, but it was fascinating to me. And it's just a really well made documentary. You really get to know all the people who run the studio, and you kind of feel like you know them personally. And there's this whole section about how the guy who runs the studio had this intense relationship with his father that ended up being part of the song Patches by Clarence Carter. If you don't know that song, YouTube it. It's an amazing song. And so there's this whole segment about how that song is a part of his life and his father and his experience. And like, there's a lot of moments like that which really make you feel like you know these people. And so by the end of the film, you know, it was a very personally affecting movie for me, even though I knew nothing about the subject before I went in. So I feel like that's the highest compliment you can give a documentary, you know? So I was definitely blown away by that. On the completely other side of the spectrum, I saw another film that I was surprised at how much I liked, actually. It's called Emmanuel and the Truth About Fishes. It's a fiction film, and it's kind of like a heightened reality fiction film. It has every single Sundance indie film cliche you could imagine in it. It's like, it's just so funny to me because, like, for me, you know, I saw the cliches and I wanted to roll my eyes, but it works. Like, they all work. It's a very beautiful, beautiful, beautiful film. One of the most beautiful films I saw at Sundance. Has an amazing score. The director's name is Francesca Gregorini. This is her second feature. She directed Tanner Hall, actually. I don't know if you guys remember that movie.
That Rooney Mara movie.
The Rooney Mara movie that made $2 in America. But yeah, no, Emmanuel and the Truth About Fishes, it's just kind of a mystical family drama about mothers and daughters. Emmanuel is a girl played by, let me see if I can get her name right, Kaya Scodeliero. She's such a beautiful screen presence. The camera loves her. She plays this kind of quirky girl. Her mother died in childbirth, so that like is still affecting her even at like 18 years old. And this next door neighbor moves in. And it's played by Jessica Biel. Her name is Linda. And she is a doppelganger for Emmanuel's dead mother. So obviously Emmanuel takes curiosity to her and the rest just gets really weird and crazy. Kind of picture like Tim Burton in the old days type of a situation with a little bit more romance. And, you know, that's kind of what you're getting here. I can't really spoil anything. But Jessica Biel is like, is great in this, and it hurts me to say that because she is she's usually so, I mean, like, you know, honestly, she spent her career being very pretty and just not strong in films, you know what I mean? Jordan knows how I feel about this, and she seems to, you know, even be box office poison a lot of the time, you know what I mean, just because for whatever reason the movies she's in don't seem to succeed. But in this particular case, she's a delightful, complicated role. She totally succeeds, plays beautifully off of Kaya, the lead actress. You have Frances O'Connor plays Kaya, plays Emmanuel's stepmother. Alfred Molina plays Emmanuel's father. They both give great performances. And yeah, like, I don't know, like, it's just, there's the teenage romances in here. Like, every cliche is totally adhered to and totally surpassed. And so I was kind of blown away by it, that it succeeded in that way. So I don't think it's been picked up yet, though.
No.
And I imagine it will be, and I imagine whoever picks it up will not be a Sony Pictures classic, so this might be a VOD type of a situation, but I definitely recommend checking it out. At the very least, you'll think it's very strange and memorable, even if you don't think it's, you know, even if you don't agree with me about its cliche success, you know, you'll definitely not forget some of the things you see in it. So,
but nice. Yeah, so for my next one, I will go with Ain't Them Body Saints, which
Ain't Them Body Saints?
Ain't Them Body Saints. So which is We repeated that about 100 times. So
about 200. Yeah.
About, yeah, I would say. Yeah, no, this is a film with definitely an intriguing title. And it's, I guess, first of all, the director said the title kind of evokes like a folk song, and which is kind of the tone he wanted to capture here. And this is from David Lowery, who is a Texas-based filmmaker. And this is his biggest project yet. He made a few smaller films. But this one stars Rooney Mara, Casey Affleck, Ben Foster, and Nate Parker. Like Dan said about his last movie, it kind of plays with, I guess, cliches a little bit. It's like, imagine, you know, if you saw Bonnie and Clyde, but they didn't die and they got captured. And this is kind of like the aftermath of what might happen. And what I loved about this movie was it kind of just is filled with like small moments rather than, you know, they don't show you a big heist in the beginning of the movie. They don't show you like all these big what should be, you know, like huge moments in these characters' lives. And that's what I really, really appreciate about it. The basic setup is that Rooney Mara and Casey Affleck are a couple who get involved with, you know, robbers basically there. And I think that takes place in just about the first 10 minutes. You see like a robbery that goes bad and they get captured and Casey Affleck goes to prison. And then the title comes up and you realize that's the first 10 minutes. And so the rest of the film is kind of like the aftermath of that. It flashes forward 4 years and Rooney Mara has a daughter, you know, that's Casey Affleck's daughter as well, but Casey Affleck can't see her obviously because he's in prison, and a whole bunch of other stuff goes down. And I would say this is very much a slow burn type of movie, but I was really with it the entire time. Amazing cinematography from Bradford Young, who had another film here called, I think Mothers of George or something like that. And, was also shot Pariah.
Yeah, Bradford Young is a name to remember in cinematography. This guy is going to be shooting big, beautiful movies, you know, in the next couple of years. And, you know, he's going to be kind of the toast of the town, I feel like, in terms of cinematography real soon. And this movie definitely showcases that.
Yeah, absolutely. The production design is amazing. Everything has a kind of like lived in environment. Feels like the whole, every setting has been around for like hundreds of years. It's just has this great like tone where almost like every word, it feels like super important, even if it's just, you know, a basic exchange between two guys. And, you know, I mean, if you've seen Casey Affleck in a film, you know that he has, you know, the power just to like the unexpected feel. We just don't know what he's going to do next, and definitely has that here. And yeah, it's just, I thought it was a really, really, really strong film, and IFC picked it up, and it should be out hopefully this year.
It's funny because we're talking about these movies and we're getting a very large disparity in terms of quality of actor. And yet apparently like you can throw out some of their histories because they've actually changed and done something like fantastic here. Like we were talking about Jessica Biel.
Yeah.
And before that, there was the guy who was apparently in Project X.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. So, no, you're right. You're right about that.
And then at the same time, you've got Casey Affleck and Rooney Mara. So it's kind of blowing my perceptions of the paradigms that these actors work in.
And honestly, you know, if I can plug, I guess, Sundance for a minute, that is really honestly probably the biggest thing that comes out of these festivals. You know, I've been to three now. I think me and Jordan have both been to three now. And I feel like every year there's at least one performance like that, you know, where you kind of come away, either it's someone who's been in, you know, like a Miles Teller who hasn't really broken out yet but has been around, or Jessica Biel, you know, where it's like she's been around and been maybe not great. And then, you know, all of a sudden, wow, like that was an amazing performance. Or, oh, wow, I didn't know that the kid from, you know what I mean, the kid from Project X actually had this like really deep, you know, personal style of acting. So I feel like every year there's something like that. Like, for example, another movie, which actually this is a good segue, Blue Caprice, which is this film starring Isaiah Washington, speaking of actors who kind of faded, and actually produced by Isaiah Washington, is this film. It's a fictional account of the Beltway sniper shootings from 2002, if you guys remember that.
Oh, yeah. I had to live through that. So
yes, you know well. So Blue Caprice is a fictional account of that true story about those two killers and how they came to meet each other, and how Washington's character, the adult, came to turn this adopted son of his into a ruthless killer. Let me get the director here for you. I believe this is his debut. His name is Alexander Moores. Yeah, all shorts before now. Yeah, special effects guy. And it's a really understated drama. It's Isaiah Washington plays John Allen Muhammad, who was the adult, and Taquan Richmond, who I believe is a new face, plays Lee Malvo, who are the two killers. And it's all about them. It's totally focused on them. It doesn't make any judgments on who these people are. It observes these two killers, you know, from beginning to end. Very, very slow-paced film. Not unlike Anthem Body Saints, actually. Like, beautiful cinematography, kind of an understated score. And Isaiah Washington gives this, like, unbelievable performance. And it's just, like, that's the dude who's in Grey's Anatomy. You know what I mean? Like, this is the guy who, like, was kind of intense and, okay in movies like True Crime. You know what I mean? Like, kind of a lo-fi Andre Brower type of a guy. And he totally blows my mind in this movie, as well as Richmond. He's like this new actor who's also like amazing to watch. And so just to that point, this is another movie where the acting is just outstanding and by people maybe you weren't expecting it from. So I definitely recommend. I don't know, that definitely hasn't been picked up. And I can tell you that it's the kind of movie that if I were a distributor, I would be afraid to buy it because I don't really know. I mean, it's a topical movie because of the gun violence conversation.
Right.
But it's also a hard movie to watch. It's not unlike the beginning of Jack Reacher last year where you're kind of like, oh, it's a fun Tom Cruise movie, but that opening 5 minutes, you know, where you're watching things happen through a sniper scope, you kind of want to close your eyes because it's maybe a little too close to home. And this movie is almost even a more psychologically unhinged version of that, but it's definitely worth watching. I hope it gets picked up by someone. So
yeah.
I would love to see that. Cause I actually grew up in the DC area when that was happening.
That's insane.
Yeah. It was not a fun time to be a child.
Yeah. I can imagine it would be a fun time.
Yeah. It was the type of thing where we had drills from like in school, you know, they used to let us meander in off of the buses, but instead now it was like a sprint to the doors.
Oof.
Yeah. Wow. It was rough.
So this one, Brian, might be hard for you. I gotta say, but
I don't know, man, because I didn't have trouble with any of the 9/11 movies that came out, and I knew people who were
right
involved in that. Well, no, that makes it sound like a new terrorist. I knew people who were in the vicinity of that, but
let's not get this podcast shut down.
Oh, no. I was about to say,
I can feel the FBI knocking on your door.
I live way too close to the NSA to be saying things like that. but yeah.
Yes. Yeah, if we want to go into another one, I think Dan and I share definitely appreciation for this film, Upstream Color.
Oh, fantastic.
Which is probably the most talked about one going into the festival, just in terms of, like, at least on our circle of friends. And this is Shane Carruth's follow-up to 2004's Primer. And judging from the trailers, you probably don't know anything regarding this movie because they're very, they don't really tell you much. But they do convey kind of what the movie is about and the style of the movie. It's pretty crazy. It is I will probably only go into the first act, just, you know, because there are some things that could easily be spoiled. You're introduced to this kind of plant that possesses something that you're not really sure what it does. Then we meet this character, or Amy Semitz, I think, Semitz or something. And she's great in this film. She's kind of the main character, where some other trailers made you think it might be Shane Carruth. But she goes through this, she gets captured and abducted and goes through this procedure where she gets, it sounds really crazy, but injected by these like worms that came from the plants, and kind of it ruins her life, because I won't really go further than that. But it ruins her life, and then she meets up with Shane Carruth, and it's kind of about rebuilding your life and your, you know, love life, relationships, when after you have gone through something that you really don't know what it was, but you knew it was something that affected you greatly. And there's a whole bunch more about it. But kind of the greatest thing about this movie, I think, is that even though you might not be sure what's going on at all times, there's definitely a compelling quality to everything you're watching. And the editing really helps that, which little side note, co-edited by Anthem Body Saints director David Lowery, which is kind of crazy.
Well, yeah, because they're both from Texas, so I assume that they would run.
Yeah,
I know, Dan, do you want to add a little anything else?
Well, yeah, I think the biggest surprise for me, I love this movie a bit more than Jordan, I think. This was probably right behind Before Midnight in the movies that affected me the most at the festival. The thing that surprised me the most going in and then seeing it without really giving too much away is that the film is a romance above all. You know, this film is a romantic narrative about these two people who are struggling with their own individual problems. And it's about how those problems begin to kind of merge into the same problems in a way that's confusing, but also entirely relatable. You know, I think it's got a clear through line, you know, a clear through line, you know, which the trailers might not suggest. It's not quite as abstract as one would probably believe going in. And sure, there are questions that are still has to be asked at the end of the film. It is definitely a watch it more than once type of experience. But I was definitely kind of blown away at how honest the core relationship of the film was, how strong the acting was. Because honestly, like the thing about Primer, which was, you know, Crew's first film, is that, you know, I like it. I like its ideas, but I don't love a lot about it. And one of the things that's really hard to get behind is the performances. You know, the performances are not strong. You know what I mean? These are people who aren't actors, and they're meant to convey these big ideas about time travel in Primer. And they don't really do, at least in my opinion, they don't do a great job in selling it. Whereas in this film, Carruth is very good. Amy Simites, who is an actress and who has been around, totally blows the door open on her own career. You know what I mean? Announces herself as this like really, really talented actress. And then everyone else, the guy who plays a character, I don't really want to spoil a character, but essentially the antagonist of the film, I believe his name is Andrew Sensenig. He's very, very solid as well. And was actually all over the Sundance Film Festival walking around. I think Jordan bumped into
a half-hour conversation with him. Yeah.
I was totally blown away. I can't wait to see it again. I know that Carruth is self-distributing in April, so I hope his film finds an audience. And I know he's planning a platform release.
Yeah.
So I hope that means, you know, it does well in 20 theaters, then it does well in 100 theaters. I know you can't expect too much from these kinds of movies, but I hope it does. If it did Tree of Life business, you know, 10 million, that would be a triumph. So,
yeah, he said when I talked to him, he said that it's going to be, he doesn't want to push the VOD release out too far. Like, he wants it to be within a month so they can capitalize on kind of the press. So, if it's not coming to your town by April or late April, you can probably get it on demand everywhere starting in early May. So,
all right, that'll be an excellent birthday present to myself.
There it is.
Because I have been looking forward to this film or any film from him since I saw Primer. And I feel like a lot of people felt that way, which is definitely why it had that huge buildup going in.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And I could just make a note of a big film, considering it won all the awards last night, all the major ones at least, Fruitvale, which won the Grand Jury Prize and the Audience Award for Dramatic Competition, which is the biggest arena, and which Beast won last year, the Audience Award.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, this is a movie. It's about the Fruitvale shooting, or the BART shooting in Los Angeles in 2009, New Year's Day. And are you familiar, Brian, at all with this shooting? I wasn't really going in.
No, I don't think I had heard about that.
The basic story is right from the get-go, you know exactly what happens because they show you actual camera footage that was captured. And it's about this guy played by Michael B. Jordan, who was in Chronicle, another star that is seriously making his breakout.
He was fantastic in Chronicle.
Yeah, this gives him a much more substantial role. He was one of the best parts. And actually Dane DeHaan too, which Dan can talk about later if he wants, is also in another Sundance movie. But so this Fruitvale is about, a guy who has a girlfriend and a daughter, and he goes out to party for New Year's Eve. And then when he returns, he kind of gets in this altercation, which the film does a great job kind of building up why he got in this altercation, because he was previously in jail. And so a guy that he met in jail that they obviously weren't friends got in a fight. But it was a very brief fight, and everyone kind of thought it was done. And then the police come to the next station he's at and restrain him and his friends and start beating his friends. And so he gets mad and then gets pulled down, and a cop shoots him and kills him. And I guess in this story, it just kind of tells you leading up to, you know, his death. But then after the aftermath is like this cop. Said it was, he thought it was his taser, and the cop only actually served like 18 months in prison, which is like crazy. And anyways, this story, follows him throughout this entire day. The director, who this is his first film, Ryan Coogler, he said that you know, about 10% is like fictional, just because, you know, there's a lot of time during this day where we, you know, there's no source of, you know, what he did. But they really, really sell. I mean, I think the greatest part of this movie is Michael B. Jordan's performance. And the movie feels very like spare. Like there's not, it feels like it's almost like, you know, in like Black Swan or something like The Wrestler, where Darren Aronofsky like employs these behind the character shots, like really long extended takes.
Yes.
That's kind of what he's going for. But it doesn't quite have like the same like cinematic quality. It almost feels like it could have been, it's not far removed almost from like, I don't want to say like documentary, but just a very like, you know, by the numbers approach. But it does, it is very, very powerful. Just, you know, the way he captures this final event and great performance of Michael B. Jordan. And the Weinstein Company will surely make this like a, try to make this a contender in the fall next year. So I bet we won't see it until late in 2013. But yeah, definitely worth seeing. You know, it'd probably be like my number five of the festival. I wasn't really as blown away as others, but it definitely hits that emotional chord that it's going for. So that is Fruitvale.
All right. Well, that's a lot of good films to sink our teeth into when they finally get around to hitting the wide release. Did we have any movies that were less than wonderful? Anything that was like your least fun experience?
I think, Jordan, why don't you...
Yeah, we want to talk about a few. There's a few that were definitely a lot, like, talked about a lot and that we were kind of just mixed on, which before we get to the truly bad ones. So,
All right.
So I think the biggest one, which Dan could discuss a little bit, but Fox Searchlight picked up this movie for $10 million called The Way, Way Back, which is the directorial debut from Nate Faxon and Jim Rash, who co-wrote The Descendants. But Dan,
Jim Rash is also the dean on Community, is he not?
Yes.
All right.
And they're actually, they both, Nat Faxon and Jim Rash both make Ninth. They do have nice small little roles in The Way, Way Back as well. The thing about this movie is I enjoyed it. I think a bit more than Jordan. I mean, it's a nice little movie in the vein of quirky family indie films, you know, a la Little Miss Sun, you know, Little Miss Sunshine, trying to capture. You know, the thing about Sundance is every year you feel like there's a couple movies that are trying to bottle the magic that was Little Miss Sunshine from that year again. And, you know, usually it fails. You know what I mean? Obviously, because these are things, you know, you can't really bottle that, you know, the luck and also the talent in that film. But so this is 2013's version of that. And it even has Steve Carell and Toni Collette in it. And, it's just about a kid who is having a rough time because his dad and his mom got divorced about a year ago, and they're going to his mom's, Toni Collette, his mom's new boyfriend, who's played by Steve Carell, his beach house, and he's just really bummed about it. And when he gets there, things aren't great. It's Steve Carell, all of Steve Carell's kind of lushy alcoholic friends are there, played by Rob Corddry and Amanda Peet and Allison Janney, who actually Allison Janney is like, is a total just wildcat, funny as hell person in this movie for at least the first 30 minutes. She's like one of the funnier performances in Sundance in the first like act of this film. But anyway, I digress. I mean, that's the movie. It's like he finds a water park near where the beach house is. Sam Rockwell is essentially playing Chevy Chase from Caddyshack. He's like this really cool, sarcastic guy. And it's a coming-of-age movie, and that's the movie. You know what I mean? It's very by the numbers. It's smartly enough written by Faxon and Rash and directed. It's, you know, pretty plainly directed. You know, it definitely feels like a first movie. Rockwell is the standout. He gives a great performance. But other than that, it's very kind of, you know, it's a very kind of a blah type of a movie. And just the fact that it was purchased for $10 million is like a shocker in a lot of ways, but also not, you know, it's like because it's so
middle of the road. Well,
I don't know. Middle of the road, I feel like, is the wrong word. But yeah, like essentially it's
very light. It's just,
it's so light and so general, you know what I mean? That I feel like it could hit the way Searchlight wants to hit and become, you know, a modest, you know, a hit film for them. because, you know, I feel like my mom and my dad would like it. You know what I mean?
That's exactly what I was saying. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you know, I feel like my mom, my dad would be like, oh, water parks, life. You know what I mean? Kids. You know,
your mom and dad sound awesome.
Your parents always tell me that too, Dan. Every time I come over, water parks, kids.
But I feel like, I think it was a smart purchase. You know what I mean? I do think it was.
I can see that too. It's just a lot.
I just think it is a classic Sundance business thing where, you know, everybody walked out of that movie being like, yeah, that was just fine. You know what I mean? And I feel like, but then you go to the public screening and it got a standing ovation for 5 minutes. So it's like, okay, yeah. You know, obviously the search, like people see that and they think this might hit, you know, and yeah. They might not be wrong. So.
Yeah. And then I can briefly discuss two disappointments for me that were still solid movies, but less than I was hoping for. One would be, which I think you guys will probably review in the coming weeks, which is Stoker, the Fox Searchlight film, another Fox Searchlight film, which Chan-Wook Park's directorial debut. This is the guy that gave us Old Boy.
No, his English-speaking
director. I was about to say.
Hollywood. I did not say Hollywood. All right, so Hollywood.
You said directorial debut.
Yes,
director. Right. Oh, Chan-Wook Park, we've never heard of him. He made him.
Exactly. No. Yeah, this one, I mean, it definitely has this like kind of twisted style, and it's very violent and just absolutely crazy. But you kind of feel that a little bit got lost in translation, just in terms of kind of the characters don't feel like they're all the way there. They're, you know, very much caricatures, which is not so much like his previous films, but there's just like some very like kind of odd tonal shifts, which is also not too much like his other films, but it just doesn't work as well here. I will say, though, that... Matthew Good gives a convincing performance as a creepy uncle. I assume most people listening have, you know, the trailer's out there, so, you know, the plot's kind of there, but it kind of is like a shadow of a doubt type situation, you know, with this uncle coming in after this family's father has passed away. And, yeah, I mean, it's enjoyable just in the vein of being kind of just wild and crazy with a lot of stylistic flourishes, which are beautiful, but just don't totally add up to a complete experience. And that comes out in a few weeks, so March 1st, I think. And then the other one that I'll mention briefly is Zal Batmanjelij, which is totally butchering it. But
totally, there's no way that sounds anything like what his name sounds like.
I know, but he's the guy who gave The Sound of My Voice, which I absolutely loved. It was on my top 10 of last year. And this is his follow-up, The East, which is also a Fox Searchlight film, and also, like Stoker, produced by Scott Free Productions, which kind of the last works that Tony Scott had his hand in. And this movie feels actually oddly, it's like taking kind of the weird qualities of Sound of My Voice in terms of like the cult and just like people getting together and kind of doing weird activities, and then adds kind of this like Tony Scott level layer of like thriller sequences. Like there's one scene in this hotel that like would not seem far removed from a Tony Scott film. And yeah, I mean, it's gets a little more, it follows this group of like eco-terrorists that are just kind of trying to do these things called jams, which will screw up these kind of big business corporate people who are harming the environment. And I really like that concept, but it just kind of gets so preposterous by the end that you're still with it in terms of just an entertaining level, but you're never as invested as you are in like Sound of My Voice, like his last film. But still a really good ensemble. Ellen Page, Alexander Skarsgård is in it. Britt Marling returns. Tony Kebbell from Rock and Rolla.
Oh, really? He's in it? I didn't know that.
Yeah, he actually has one of the best characters. So, I mean, it's worth seeing, I would say, but just kind of a disappointment following Sound of My Voice.
Following the masterpiece that is Sound of My Voice.
Exactly, Dan. I know you're with me on
that movie. That movie is so good. And by the way, his name is Toby Kebbell, not Tony Kebbell.
Toby Kebbell, sorry.
But yeah, I did not see The East or Stoker, so I will be with the rest of the Minions in a theater seeing it, paying good money. But I am excited, even though Jordan was a little disappointed on both. I would say I'm trying to think of disappointments for me. I mean, mostly, you know, I guess this isn't a disappointment, but there was another music documentary called Sound City that got a decent amount of hype coming into the festival because – it was what's his name? Dave Grohl. Dave Grohl directed it. He kind of got all of his friends, all of his famous, you know, Paul McCartney, you know, all of these famous musician friends to be in it. And it's about similarly to Muscle Shoals, it is about a
recording studio called Sound City in the Valley in LA that produced all these great records over the decades and decades of good music. Unfortunately, it just, and Jordan, and I know Jordan agrees with me on this, it just does not hit the same way at all. It's a strangely directed movie by Grohl. Like, clearly he kind of should have probably had another more confident directing hand by his side. There's some very strange, like, he doesn't get the most out of his interview subjects. You know, you have people say lines that are very repetitious. Like, people, they repeat their emotions about certain things four or five times. There are these weird side jokes that happen that just don't hit. He over-explains some things about the music recording business, and then he, like, under-explains a lot. There are a lot of in-jokes that no one would get unless you knew Grohl. So I don't know. It just really didn't work for me. And that was kind of a bit of a disappointment in terms of just all the talent involved. So that one really stuck out for me. Yeah.
If we want to talk about another much hyped movie that I think we both felt similarly about, Escape from Tomorrow, right. Which is, I think it had about a few screenings before, like about probably two screenings before we saw it. And this is a film which I'm sure if you've been following any Sundance coverage the last week, you've seen interviews with the director and cinematographer maybe, or the star. And this is a film which was secretly shot on Walt Disney World property and Disneyland. And it's kind of like this mind trip through, but it's not really that crazy at all, which is kind of why Dan and I were disappointed about it. But it's just this guy who, in the first scene, he gets fired. And he's already on vacation with his family, so he's trying to enjoy this last day at Disney World as much as possible. And do you want to talk a little bit about why you don't like it, Dan?
Yeah, I mean, so the whole, this is like another kind of Sundance staple, right? There's always a smaller movie. There seems to be always a smaller movie that either has a gimmick, or sometimes a gimmick works or whatever, that it strikes people. Like, I would even call Beasts of the Southern Wild what this was last year. You know what I mean? Like, a small movie that that people seem to just really latch onto for whatever reason, even though Beast obviously worked a lot better. But it was shot in Disney World and Disneyland. The guy had a DSLR camera. I think it was like a Mark II 5D. And he literally just ran around with these actors who aren't especially talented, and shot this like sub Lynchian, family psychodrama where it's about like this dad who is obsessed with women, and there's a perversity there, and it's all about how, Disney World wants every girl and boy to feel like a prince and a princess, and how that warps, like, literally in the film, warps their views of the world, and conceptually it's interesting, of course, like, that sounds interesting. Like, as I'm saying that, I want to see that movie, but the movie, you just can't escape the fact that it's, poorly shot, poorly acted, poorly written. You know what I mean? And so the novelty of, ooh, he shot this illegally in Disney World and Disneyland, or probably won't ever come out because, Disney's going to sue and blah, blah, blah. Like, if I were Disney, I wouldn't be that worried, because when people see the movie, they're going to be like, oh, that was kind of stupid. You know what I mean? And I hate to be that. I hate to be that crass. But I mean, that's really what it comes down to. And the hype machine that was built on the Friday night screening of this movie was so large that by the time we saw it on Sunday, me and Jordan both walked out kind of being like, what?
Is this one of those ones where you think maybe you'd seen it before, you'd had a chance to hear other people's reaction, you might have felt?
Well, me and Jordan were talking about this. Yes. I feel like, here's my thing. If I had seen it on Friday night, knowing nothing about it, I might have been definitely more intrigued by the premise. The problem is, even if I had seen it 2 days earlier, I still would have had to think about it afterwards, and I think I would have still gotten to the same conclusion. You know what I mean? Like, over time. You know what I mean? I just don't think. I think the novelty would have just taken a little bit longer to wear off. But yeah, it's definitely a movie that and look, I'm happy, obviously, when any small movie gets recognition like the one that movie's getting, you should be happy for the movie, even if you don't like it, because it's a creative process. People will give their lives to these films. The fact that they got into Sundance is a triumph, and I hope people see it. It's just the kind of thing that I just didn't feel like I saw other small movies that were very impressive, and this just did not compare. And that's, you know, just simply put, that's kind of what it comes down to. So,
right.
Yeah.
And any out and out misfires before we wrap this up?
There's one major one.
Well, there's, two.
There's two.
Okay.
I'm going to go with my.
You go with, yours. I'll do it.
All right. So the very first film we saw at Sundance. And these two movies we're going to talk about are bad for very different reasons, I think.
All right.
One, the one that I saw is from someone in the Hess family, which is obviously the people that gave us Napoleon Dynamite. And they're just on a spiral downward with Nacho Libre, then what was it? Gentleman's Broncos. And this is from
Jerusha
Hess, which is wife of Napoleon Dynamite director. And this is called Austinland. And it kind of has a neat concept that that some people may think is intriguing, which is a girl, Felicity Jones, or sorry, not Felicity Jones.
Kara Russell, star of Felicity. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I've been watching too much Felicity because my wife watches it. So there you go. And so she is this diehard Jane Austen fan, and kind of really overboard. Her room is filled with everything, you know, with everything from a Colin Firth stand up.
That's cut out of. Yeah, Mr. Darcy.
Exactly, Mr. Darcy. And so kind of her friend kind of gets mad at her for, you know, living this dream life, or, you know, her romantic interests are warped by kind of this vision. So she's like, you know, why don't you, she discovers that there's this trip called, you know, to Austinland. It's kind of like this dream vacation where you can literally live the life of a Jane Austen protagonist, specifically Pride and Prejudice. And she's like, if you go on this and it lives up to your wildest fantasies, then by all means, keep living this lifestyle. If not, you have to get rid of all this stuff and just be a normal person. And so she goes, and what follows is a very dry, very uninteresting, very conventional, very annoying, just all everything combined. Just so very misguided, too, in terms of... you know, it plays by the numbers, but the numbers that it plays by is like, just, you know, there's these characters make decisions that you're just kind of confused about, and it just kind of, by the end, it does fall into what you expected from the very beginning. There's no real surprises, even though they want you to think that there will be, and yeah, just a really, really terrible way to start off Sundance. So I'm glad I almost already forgot it just talking about it now. So
Yeah. No, I mean, it's, you know, I was there as well, and I can just quickly, I'll just say, yeah, I mean, it has an intriguing premise that has a, you know, has a particular niche, you know, appeal to it, but yeah, it just gets everything wrong. I mean, it just, half of it wants to be Napoleon Dynamite, and then the other half wants to be Notting Hill, you know what I mean? And it just, you know, is neither of those things. You know, it's a bad alchemy. You know what I mean? So I feel like, I don't know if it's, you know, Jerusha Hess's fault. I think we can all agree, if the Hess family could stop making films, that would be appreciated. And that is all I will I'll say. And yeah. Kerry Russell, man, why? It's annoying. She's not bad. She's a fine actress. She's pretty. She's talented. She's got a look to her. You know what I mean? She's got
that new TV show come out on FX, right?
The Americans. Which I'm hoping will be good. But, like, she's in Dark Skies. Like, what? From the director of Priest? Come on, man. Just come on, Kerry Russell. Just, I don't know. Yeah. Figure it out. But anyway, I'm done. But that is my Austinland take. The last and final movie we'll talk about is by far the worst movie at Sundance. It is called The Necessary Death of Charlie Countryman, starring Shia LaBeouf and Evan Rachel Wood and Mads Mikkelsen and Till Schweiger. And I purposely said his name wrong.
Shia LaBeouf. Oh, okay. I wasn't sure.
And Rupert Grint, a.k.a. Ron Weasley, is in this film. And it is horrible. It's a horrible movie directed by Frederick Bond, who's a very big commercial director. He's been around for a while directing any number of, you know, big commercials. And it shows in this movie because this movie is a kinetic mess. This movie is the example of infantile filmmaking with a big budget. You know what I mean? There's special effects that don't work. Shia LaBeouf does his, like, even Stevens comedy routine a couple times that does not fit with the tone of his character. Evan Rachel Wood, though I actually kind of enjoyed her, sports this ridiculous accent. The movie takes place in Bucharest for no foreseeable reason. This is actually how the movie explains why it takes place in Bucharest, right? This is the beginning of the film, right? Okay. Charlie Countryman's mom, played by a totally wasted, totally horrible Melissa Leo, dies. And then Charlie, who's hopped up on all these drugs, imagines his mom comes back to life, and his dead mom, tells him to go to Bucharest, because why the fuck not? And he goes to Bucharest, and that is why he goes. And when he falls in love with Evan Rachel Wood, who is spoken for by this like horrible gangster named Nigel, played by Mads Mikkelsen, is usually good in these kinds of movies, right? He's a very strong actor. And like even in a Clash of the Titans situation, he's good. You watch a movie like Clash of the Titans, which isn't strong, but you walk away from it being like, oh, but you know what? That guy, what was his name? Mads Mikkelsen? He was interesting to watch. This is the exact opposite of that. He is the most boring character in the film. He looks in scenes like he's looking past the camera to a guy holding his paycheck. Like it is the most... It's his worst performance. Jordan, wouldn't you agree? It's like his
worst performance.
It's horrible. And like Shia, like I respect that he's doing these things because this movie is at least it tries to be inventive. You know what I mean? This is the movie that he said. This is the movie that Shia said he dropped acid for. I don't know if you remember that news story.
Oh, I do remember that. That was
And so there's a whole 10-minute like acid trip scene, which like. Is interesting to watch, I guess. I mean, there's like pop music and pretty colors, but I mean, this is a movie that kids are going to see when they're 15. And I wrote this in my review. Kids are going to see it when they're 15, 16. They haven't seen a whole lot of films, just like Boondock Saints. And they're going to see it and they're going to be like, oh, this feels rebellious. I don't really understand it. Maybe that means it's smart.
That cuts close to home for me with the Boondock Saints reference. Not the smart part, but just the, energy, rebellion.
But you know what I'm saying? No, because that's what happened to me, man. When I was 15 or whatever and I saw Boondock Saints, I loved it. Like, I loved it. I was like, this movie must be awesome because, like, there's crazy violence and there's blood and there's drugs and there's pop music and I feel like that means it's good And then you see the Pulp Fiction movie and you see the Godard films and then you're like, oh, wait a minute. This is just like the fourth tier version of those masterpieces. You know what I'm saying?
And the one good thing I can say about that, though, is it does act as a kind of gateway drug into better movies.
And let me say that I pray that Charlie Countryman is a gateway for people. Like, yes, that's the best thing it could be, is a movie that you see and you're like, oh, this feels good. And then you're like, oh, I want to see this movie by this director, Quentin Tarantino. Oh, I want to see this movie by this director, Robert Rodriguez, you know? And you're like, oh, okay. Like, that's that's what this movie was trying to be. And that's honestly what it boils down to. It's a very derivative, you know, offensive, you know, just, you know, piece of trash. But, like, you know, hopefully the kind of trash that will yield better results for people who like the movie in later years. So we'll see. But not a strong film. I don't recommend it. Hasn't been picked up. I'm sure it will be picked up by someone.
Yeah.
All right. I do have one final question before we go. Did either of you see Don John's Addiction?
Raffi saw it.
He can read his review. He enjoyed it quite a bit.
All right. Yeah. Excellent.
He gave it a solid B+ and had a lot of good things to say about it.
Yeah.
I had a series of movies in my head that if I didn't hear about, I was going to ask. And one by one, you plucked each of them off, except for that one.
Well, the good thing about Don John's is that it got picked up by Relativity Media for, I believe, $6 million.
Wow.
But with a promise of a $25 million P&A campaign. So that means that they're going to release it wide. You're going to see posters for it. They're going to try to make it. I think they're going to try to make it into a funny version of Shame.
Oh, nice. Fantastic.
I've heard about it. So hopefully, you know, I'm sure you'll be able to see it and everybody listening will be able to see it in the coming months. So.
And Shame was my number two film of that year. So a funny version, you know, that can only be better.
You know, a laugh riot version of Shame.
And I also will say there are a handful of films we didn't mention, but you can read our full reviews, like David Gordon Green's Prince Avalanche, which was solid, and Adam Scott starring ACOD, and another film I saw called Toys House. So, like, you can read all our full reviews of those. So.
Yes, exactly. Go to thefilmstage.com for full coverage of the Sundance Film Festival. Before we sign off, I know that someone out there is wondering what is coming to Blu-ray and DVD and to theaters that you should see. So January 29th, Seven Psychopaths hits Blu-ray. You should definitely check it out.
Love that movie.
Yeah, it was fantastic. And then coming to theaters, Warm Bodies, Bullet to the Head, The Haunting 2, and Stand Up Guys. Stand Up Guys looks like it could be pretty good.
I've heard good and bad.
All right.
I saw one really bad trailer, and then I saw another trailer that was really good. So now I just don't know what to think anymore. And
let me tell you something. Jordan Hoffman, if I can shout that gentleman out. Jordan Hoffman on his, I don't know, maybe it was film.com. He reviewed it when it came out briefly in December and said that there is a good movie somewhere in the Stand Up Guys. So that means that, you know, there's probably parts of the movie that are good. So.
There's also two Sundance films coming to theaters.
Oh, really?
One is Sound City, so you should not see it.
Yep, avoid that shit.
And then The Gatekeepers, which is an Oscar-nominated doc, which one of our friends, actually Sam Fragoso, who did a few reviews on our site, he quite liked it.
Yeah, I've known Sam for going on 2 years, I guess. So
nice.
I was happy to see him helping us out at Sundance.
He was a pleasure to have.
Excellent. And Warm Bodies is also coming out, and... I don't know. I've heard decent things about that.
Yeah, same here. I heard it's solid. So, yeah.
So not the first fairly decent weekend of the new year, I guess.
Amen.
Really, really low praise. But anyway, let us tell the fine people where we can be found before next week if they'd like to check us out before our next podcast. So, Dan, why don't you kick us off?
Yeah, you can find all my news stories and reviews on thefilmstage.com and follow me on Twitter at DJ Mecca. That's M-E-C-C-A. DJ M-E-C-C-A at Twitter.
Yeah, but you are not actually a DJ.
Am I? I am a DJ. Yes, I am.
But you're not like
I'm a disc jockey, and my name is Daniel John. Yes.
You are actually a disc jockey.
No, I'm not.
Okay, because I was about to say that is incredible the way that worked out. Oh, man. Fated by the gods to one day spin discs. Jordan, what about yourself?
Oh, yeah. You can follow me, obviously, on the film stage and at Twitter, on my personal Twitter, at JP Ralph, or at the film stage.
And you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/BrianJRowan. You can also find me on the film stage and at my personal blog, dearfilm.net. So, ladies and gentlemen, once again, thank you for joining us, and come back next week.